You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great week and there's tons to watch this weekend. I have some good news. Netflix just released this trailer for a forthcoming documentary due out September 28th. This is going to look at Britney Spears' 13-year conservatorship battle. Now, of course, we've watched the one done by the New York Times. I've interviewed the director. The trailer came out and a narrator can be heard saying, "No one would talk until they did." Now, Britney Spears' camp has apparently said that they have not seen it, that there's another unauthorized documentary without her blessing or participation. But they also say in this Page Six article that she can't watch any of this because she's so easily triggered. So who knows? It's called Britney versus Spears. I will say this. The director is Erin Lee Carr, and she is excellent. She is a two-time Emmy-nominated filmmaker, and she's really known for exploring criminal justice, femininity, and virality. She directed the critically acclaimed I Love You, Now Die, The Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter. This was the film about the texting suicide case that captured national interest. She did the May of 2019 At the Heart of Gold inside the USA Gymnastics scandal, which shone a light on the brave survivors of abuse by a former Olympic team physician by the name of Dr. Larry Nassar. And she also did Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. So she's an excellent filmmaker, and I really feel like she will do a fantastic job. So look forward to that next week, September 28th. It's called Britney versus Spears on Netflix. This week on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which is every Wednesday night, and it's been obviously a very crazy season, I find that every week unpacking the life of Kathy Hilton to be so interesting. I've wanted her to be on the show for so long because we have seen the relationship dynamics between her younger sisters, Kyle and Kim. And I feel like with each person of someone's family that you add to the picture, you get a better scope of who they are in the world and what kind of set up their decision-making process based on their life experience. So Kathy Hilton's fascinating because, as Kyle explained, she was basically coddled by their mother as the oldest child. And then when she was 19, she married her husband, who's from a wealthy family. And so she went from being coddled by her mother to being coddled by her husband and the staff of people that have worked around them. So here she is. She's a grandmother now, and she is so reliant on a staff and even her sister to do things for her. She's got this palatial estate in Beverly Hills, and she talks about how much it's so hard to do dinner parties, but the honest truth is she's got a staff that does everything for her, makes the food, cleans the house, cleans the silverware, serves the food, cleans it up. And then in this latest episode, she realizes that she's left her phone and her purse and her bag at home. Because she doesn't drive anywhere, this is not top of mind. You know, most of us check when we get to the car to see that we have everything, but she's driven everywhere. So her sister lives in Encino. Kathy lives in Beverly Hills. If you don't know Southern California, just know this. It is a colossal headache to drive anywhere, especially in the LA area because of traffic. So to go from Encino back to Beverly Hills and then get on the highway, you're asking for another hour, hour and a half out of your way. So Kathy says to Kyle, you're going to have to call my house. So Kyle asks her, well, who do I call when I call your house? And by the way, no one has a house phone anymore in the year 2021. Most people have cell phones, but she's so old school, she's got a house phone, presumably because she's an estate manager. Kyle asks her, who do I call when I reach your house? Just call the lady. She doesn't even know the person's name who's her estate manager. I just can't even unpack all of that. To be that wealthy and not have any idea where your bag and your phone is because you're driven everywhere, the fact that you don't even know the name of the person that runs your home, anyway, watch the show every Wednesday. There's the whole Erica thing too, but to see obscene wealth like that and to kind of get a peek into the window of how they live their life, I find to be extraordinarily interesting. Also, this week, Erica Jane candidly addressed her estranged husband's dementia diagnosis and healthcare plan. So at one point she says, in reference to a Page Six article, which I'm like, she's like, someone sent it to me. I'm like, you definitely stay up and read every Page Six article. It says Tom's brother asked the court to give him the authority to place Tom in a facility that treats neurocognitive disorders such as dementia. I'm ready to have a nervous breakdown. Regardless of what's going on legally, this is someone that I was married to for 22 years. So it's a little bit interesting because now the narrative is, I'm so upset because I love this man so much. How could you love someone that basically put you in such a precarious legal situation and you're telling us that you have no more money, that you're going to be flooded with lawsuits? How could you still have an iota of love for him, especially when you know that he's cheated people out of millions and millions of dollars of settlements? People that are in different parts of the world and live basically in shacks and are struggling. I can't make heads or tails of it. It's like ebbs and flows every episode. And then Dorit mentions the car accident. And then Erica says under her breath, allegedly. So, I mean, it's just like a word salad all the time. So anyway, again, I know I've said this before, every episode of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills this season, it's like a puzzle that you're trying to unravel and you've got to watch it. This episode I'm so excited about because I have the most excellent docuseries for you to watch on HBO. And I am so excited to tell you about it. My guest today in this episode is Niall Coppello, executive producer of The Way Down, a documentary series premiering on HBO Max on September 30th in its first three episodes. This five-part documentary series is about the controversial Remnant Fellowship Church and its founder, the late Gwen Shamblin Lara. I watched this a couple weeks ago. I believe this to be the best documentary series of 2021. I have been trying to unpack it ever since I watched it, and I'm very certain you will do the same. The documentary explores the story of Gwen Shamblin Lara's rise to fame and power as a diet guru and church leader, revealing the surprising truth behind closed doors. This encompasses 2 years of extensive research, interviews, and investigation. The Way Down details the controversial practices of the Remnant Fellowship, including stories of abuse and exploitation, as told by former members and others who were personally impacted. This masterful filmmaking team behind The Way Down includes an Emmy award-winning director. They have created a fascinating documentary that is not only shocking, but also uncovers a story that's surprisingly relatively unknown, with the founder of this church passing away in a plane crash this year. Gwen Shamblin Lara was an American author. She was founder of this Christian diet program called The Way Down Workshop, and also the founder of the Remnant Fellowship Church. She earned an undergraduate degree in dietetics from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville and her master's degree in food and nutrition from Memphis State University. She was a registered dietitian, consultant, and a faculty member at Memphis State University for 5 years and worked in the Tennessee Department of Health for 5 years. So with that expertise, she begins a weight control consulting practice in 1980. She says that she had struggled with her weight in college. But the surprising thing is she counseled that genetics, metabolism, and behavior modification did not explain why some people were thin while others were overweight. So in her search to figure it all out, she creates this program tied in with the church. So in 1986, she founds the Way Down Workshop, a weight loss program with no food restrictions, exercise regimens or weigh-ins, or calorie counting. So instead, it was about essentially praying the pounds away. Obviously, some experts expressed concern that this program eliminated exercise and guidance on food selection, as recommended by the American Dietetic Association. So by 1994, she and her husband, who had created the program, they offered it in Europe and in about 600 churches and in 35 U.S. states. Years later, this would develop into a staff of 40. They would build a headquarters in Franklin, Tennessee. She began hosting an annual summer convention, Desert Oasis, in the Nashville area. They hosted more than 21,000 classes for more than 250,000 participants worldwide by August of 1998. Classes were hosted in every state in the U.S. and in Canada and Europe, and she was all over TV. Larry King would have her on all the time. You'd see her on the Today Show. She was this teeny tiny blonde woman with a beautiful Southern accent who seemed to have all the answers. I can help you in your faith, and I can also help you lose weight. So vulnerable people lost in their own faith and with their health looked to her for answers. So with her husband, she begins the Remnant Fellowship, which, as mentioned, she founded in 1999. This was with her first husband, David Shamblin. She had been a member of the Church of Christ, split off from that church to create her own church. So she's got the diet plan, which sets aside common health guidelines and instead focuses on a reliance on God and then creates the church to support it, urging members that in order to understand the true hunger, they should eat only when their stomachs growled. And though through appearances on popular shows like Larry King Live and Fortune, thanks to best-selling books, touting her strategies to lose weight, it also made her a controversial figure with critics saying that she focused more on unconventional theology than healthy eating habits. So here's where it gets weird. By 2018, she divorces the first husband, David, with some former congregants suggesting that he had been bad for her brand because one, they had marriage problems and she wanted to present herself as somebody who could help you figure out all life's problems by relying on her and relying on God. But also because David, her first husband, had been overweight. He'd struggled with his own weight. So if she couldn't help him with his own weight loss struggle, then he'd have to go. So she divorces him and very soon after marries someone by the name of Joe Lara, who had been an out-of-work actor and a struggling want to be country music star. So they get married, they have a big wedding in front of the congregation, and then people become charmed by their love story and the power. She had two children from her first marriage, Michael and Elizabeth, who were visible. Michael eventually kind of went to the side after he struggled with his own addiction issues, and Elizabeth, with her small children and doting husband, appear in church videos. So the documentary examines these controversial views on weight loss, but also obedience. So along with allegations that the church shunned and even harassed members who wanted to leave, the church functioned more as a cult, according to congregants, than a traditional religious institution. So ex-members describe in the documentary that the church was less a place of worship and more of an all-encompassing power that took over every aspect of their lives. So from where they worked and how they dressed to whom they married, body image and appearances were central components, and the documentary chronicles her own transformation from this bubbly young dietitian with this girl next door looks into a very thin, very, very thin older woman, heavily made up, whose hair seemed to grow in height in relation to her power. It began as just regular hair. By the end of this, her hair is so high, and it makes you wonder if all of the disordered eating caused hair loss and if she was wearing a wig to present herself as healthier, even though she was privately struggling. Gwen Shamblin Lara's broader popularity eventually began to wane in part because of her rejection of the Holy Trinity, views that prompted a Christian publisher to cancel her upcoming book and others to stop promoting her weight loss program. Crazy thing is, she used misogyny against other women as a form of control in this Remnant Fellowship Church. And she was one of the few female religious leaders in the evangelical Christian movement, but she had an entirely male leadership team. And she demanded that her congregants adhere to traditional familial gender roles in order to maintain their standing in the church. So among the allegations raised in the series are accusations that individuals unable to lose that weight were marginalized by the church community, and that members were encouraged by Remnant leadership to stop taking prescribed medication, including birth control and psychiatric drugs. So what's crazy is that in May of this year, a single pilot Jane plane crashed into a lake near Nashville, and it killed all 7 people on board, which included Gwen, her husband Joe, 2 couples from the Remnant Fellowship Church, and then her son-in-law. And now Elizabeth Shamblin is now the de facto leader of the church. So I'm thrilled that Niles will be with me today to talk about this most interesting documentary series. And I'm telling you, you are going to do so much Google research. You are going to look through videos on YouTube because you're not going to be able to believe what a crazy story this is. So here we go with Niles. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KateCasey for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KateCasey to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KateCasey. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmerman dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Congratulations. I know this took 2 years of investigative work. How did you find this story?
It's a great question, and thank you so much. It is, as you said, the result of a lot of hard work, and it's really just been such an honor, and I'm so excited to share this story with everyone. I feel like I've been, you know, sitting on it for so long, and so I'm just excited for everyone to be able to hear these people's stories. My background's in investigative journalism and storytelling generally, and as a would like to think strong woman raised by a very strong woman, single mom from a long line of single women, of strong mothers and women in my family. I am very interested in when that strength and power can be used in different and sometimes nefarious ways. Mm-hmm. So I am always drawn to stories of women using their strength for good and also, you know, and sometimes for bad and, you know, with disastrous consequences, as you see here. So for me, it was really Gwen and her as a woman using, you know, very often misogyny to control other women. And that component, those layers were what really, you know, immediately made me feel like this was, a story that needed to be told. On top of that, it being, you know, current and ongoing, I'm always looking for those types of stories. You know, I think as someone who works in true crime, there's a lot of value to telling these stories. But for me, I'm always looking for like, what is the impact? What is the why? You know, it's not just here's this story, but it's why are we telling this story? And this for me really hit on that, where it was like, there's such an important why because it's happening right now. And people don't realize that things like this are still happening every single day in hundreds of churches across the country. And that's the reality of it. So, you know, it really was me. I'm always looking for stories. I'm always looking for these powerful women figures, you know, in all sorts of different roles. And Gwen really stuck out to me as an interesting character study from that perspective.
So fascinating. So tell me about how her faith really was the cornerstone for her life. Her family followed the Church of Christ. How did that make an indelible mark on her life and in her faith?
Yeah, the Church of Christ, you know, she comes from a strong evangelical background. I think the fact that this is a story set in Tennessee, you know, she was raised in Memphis, Waydown and Remnant are based in right outside of Nashville. You know, that context is really important to this story as well, because there is, you know, it's Bible Belt. There's this really strong Christian faith there, especially evangelical. And you know, I don't know if I fully understood what evangelical meant until this project, because the whole basis of evangelical Christian is you have this message and other people either, you know, they need to listen to it or there's nothing else. And so Church of Christ has a very similar structure in the sense that this is the one true church and all other churches are not true. And that is very different than your typical Christian church. You know, most Christian churches, you go, maybe you move, you know, you get a new job and you move your family to another church and there's no hard feelings. There's no pressure right. to stay and make it work. You know, there are churches that participate in conferences and big networks and, you know, that work together. This is not that. This is a church that believes that if you are not part of this church, you are going to hell. Full stop. So that idea does come from Church of Christ. So, you know, her background of this really, you know, strong Christian evangelical background in Church of Christ clearly set her up for this idea that there is one correct church, one correct way to approach Christianity. That is very present in her ideology. That is basically the foundation of Remnant Fellowship. And so that idea is, you know, why she ended up starting Remnant. At the beginning, it was, you know, Waydown, which was Christian-based weight loss. So it was, you're struggling with your weight, instead of going to Weight Watchers, you're a Christian woman, and you go to Waydown, and you, you know, start cutting your portions in half, and you start, you know, instead of what she says is if you don't show the physical signs of hunger, if your stomach is not actively growling, you are not supposed to eat. You are supposed to pray. So, of course, people lost a lot of weight and it was very successful. But that program was being taught in churches across the country, the, you know, Baptist, you know, church, like all sorts of Christian churches were incorporating her program. You know, it was like an optional add-on. You're part of our congregation, you're struggling with your weight, here, do the weigh down program. It was really in, you know, when she announced that she denounced the Trinity and announced her church at the same time at this Desert Oasis conference in 1999, that she really started to diverge. And at that point, that was when it moved from being not a program taught in other churches, but a church itself. And that, I think, goes back to that Church of Christ ideology where she was seeing people do the program, but still put back on the weight. And she blamed that on the fact that they were still in these environments. They were still in their home churches, surrounded by their normal, you know, their friends and family from before the program. She felt that it would be, how much more successful would these people be if they were fully, you know, only surrounded by other people that were doing this program and committed to this lifestyle and committed to this faith. And so that, you know, that I think does really go back to this Church of Christ idea that there is one true church. And so, you know, thinking on that, you can't just teach your program in other churches. You have to establish that church yourself. And so that's really where this all came from.
Her relationship with her own weight, she studied nutrition and it was obviously a passion. Where did it move from passion to obsession?
It's a great question. I mean, her, you know, she's gone through a lot of lengths to really shroud her background and there's still a lot of mystery and a lot of questions there. She was raised by, her father was a doctor. And so she, you know, credits to growing up in that environment. And then when she went to college, she started studying nutrition. She has said that during that time in college, she put on like, you know, the freshman 15, kind of the typical college weight. But it seems that that was really impactful for her. And somewhere between her gaining that weight, graduating college, meeting her first husband, David Shamblin, it seems that this really went from an interest in nutrition and, you know, coming from someone who has a background in Christianity and Church of Christ to being, you know, her own ideology and her own, you know, I mean, in certain sense, religion. So that, you know, evolution, I think really, it seems that she credits a lot of that to when she first gained the weight and that she kind of went searching for what is a way where I can lose this weight and be a skinny eater, be a, you know, give myself more over to God at the same time that I'm losing weight. So she credits it to her going on this own path of how can I marry these two things that I'm looking for in life. And it seems that, you know, I think like you see with a lot of these people, you see it with celebrities, you see it with reality TV stars, yeah. The fame and the following and the power is intoxicating. Absolutely. And there's really, you know, I think one of the things that Marina and our editing team does really well is show Gwen's descent over time. Mm-hmm. You know, from when she really started putting this stuff out in the world, 1999, 2000 is right when she started, you know, denounced the Trinity, started the church, was really moving in this direction. She was like this, you know, sprite, young, full of life woman, who clearly had a genuine passion for God. You know, I mean, we can debate whether that was misguided from the outset, but you know, she, there was a real liveliness to her and charisma. And I think you can see why people wanted to be around that. Mm-hmm. And over time, as her ideology has gotten more and more extreme and more intense and more oppressive, and you hear these stories unfold, obviously over the course of the doc, you get into the Joseph Smith stuff, her exterior seems to almost reflect that evolution. And you see her just deteriorate. And, you know, it's interesting. We've asked ourselves a lot of those questions. What is the turning point? When did this happen? And I think, you know, that was sort of the kickoff, was this weight gain. But it seems like, I think it really was this rolling ball of just Christianity and weight loss and power. Mm-hmm. That the more successful it became, the more dangerous it became as well.
I also wondered, you know, many people kind of make fun of the hair thing because it just got bigger. But I wondered if it was masking hair loss because she's so frail by the end of the docuseries or the third part where I'm looking at her worried about her own personal health. And I wondered if that was maybe a weave or a wig to mask a lot of hair loss.
I've certainly thought the same thing. I mean, it's, you know, to me, it's clear, and I'm not a psychologist. I don't want to like play a psychologist here, but when I look at her, I think of a woman who's clearly suffering from her own insecurities, definitely. You know, who clearly is struggling with getting older and wanting her husband to find her attractive. I mean, you see these conversations that she had with other women. That to me screams, I'm unhappy and I feel unworthy and I feel overweight and I feel ugly. And that, you know, I have a certain amount of empathy there, sure. For her, you know, as a woman who understands what it's like to be a woman in this world, and especially from the background that she came from. And I do think that her exaggerated makeup and the hair, I mean, I'm not sure if this ended up in the doc, but their faces are white because they put cornstarch in them. And like, there's all of these things that they do, the hair and the cornstarch and the lipstick and the coloring that is trying to almost breathe life into a lifeless person. That's the way that I view it. And so I do think that it's, you know, you see her getting older and you see the hair getting bigger and the makeup getting caked on more. And it's sad. It's her trying to, you know, hold on to youth that is clearly escaping her. But I also think you see how those insecurities ate her alive. And then she allowed that to eat other people alive. You know, that's a projection. I assume, I think, you know, It feels like a projection of her own insecurities. And I understand that we've all been like, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, catty middle school girls where like you feel insecure. And so you say something mean to someone else. Like that element seems very present here. And I think that the hair and all of these things that she does, there's a sadness there to me. You know, it is, you can poke fun of it. There's, you know, it's comical. It is. The hair is crazy. But the hair represents, you know, a real decaying, I think.
Absolutely. Of her. Yeah. And also that she was born into this patriarchal structure of Church of Christ. And then she has power. And then surprisingly, the leadership is all men. And she, at one point in the documentary, there's a video of her making a structure. And she says, God is first. And then she puts a list of authority figures. And she really is teaching her congregants to be reliant on a succession of authority figures before oneself. So there's so much internal struggle that's going on, which makes her such a complicated, interesting person. I wanted to ask you about her marriage. So she was married to David Shamblin for 20 years. It would seem that she quietly divorced him because it's bad for brand for two reasons. One, you want to present yourself as somebody who's fully happy, and she's encouraging her congregants to stay married, but also that he struggled with his weight. Did I see that in the right way? Or is that what the sense that you guys got?
So there's two parts to this, I think. You know, there's the component of why was David Shamblin not involved in Remnant? And I think that that is the question that you just answered. He struggled with his weight. He also, you know, we haven't spoken to him, but we've heard that he was not, he sort of understood some of the dangers. He has a theology background. He has a degree in theology. So he comes from a strong Christian background, and it seems that he knew that there was something not right here. But they were making a lot of money. He's a businessman, and they had a lot of investments. Wow. And it seems that there was a bit of an agreement of, I'm going to hang out at home and you can go and do your thing. You know, I think lots of men in traditional Christian families think that, like, my wife has her thing and I have my things. I go golfing and she does this. And I get the feeling that that's sort of what David had thought for a while, was like, that's just her thing. I don't need to be fully in. It doesn't matter. And obviously over time, when she's, you know, preaching obedience to, and, you know, weight loss and all of these things, questions came up about, you know, but what about your husband? He's not here. He's not overweight. So that was definitely there. But she stayed married, and she made herself basically a martyr. She called them Beulah wives. So she was the ultimate Beulah wives, and all of the Beulah wife. And all of these Beulah wives were women whose husbands were not part of Remnant, who were in Remnant and doing way down, but their husbands were not.
Wow.
And she really put herself up as this martyr. And we had other Beulah, you know, former Beulah wives who spoke to us and said, we were in those rooms with her talking, you know, her putting herself up as, well, I'm, you know, I don't have the support and I'm still doing it. And if I can do it, you can do it. So I almost think that she used that as really, you know, she used it to her advantage for a long time. The reason that she ended up divorcing David is because she met Joe, without a question.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone believes that her and David would have split if Joe had not come into the picture, because he seems to have, it seems like they had come to a agreement of the way that things were working, and they both seemed okay with that. It was clearly not either of their ideal situations.
Yeah.
But you know, when Gwen met Joe, I think that he offered what David didn't.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? He was willing to be right alongside her, to say what she wanted him to say, to do it, dress the way that she wanted him to dress. He was, you know, slim, good looking, a former actor. It was like, oh my God, great. This is easy. And he also was looking for things. And it seemed like it just made sense for them, you know? And that was really what finally gave her the push to divorce David and go through with that. And then it became, divorce is no longer a problem with the church. You know, after you have years and years of these women coming to her and asking to be granted divorces and being denied, you know, all of a sudden she meets Joe and it's okay. And so that, you know, really has shaken things up. But I think everyone, you know, within the church also, you know, it seems that that is generally the interpretation of what happened.
Unbelievable. And he is such a strange figure. as people will see in the docuseries, he was married previously. He has a daughter. There's a lot to unpack there. He's such a strange figure, but to your point, it seemed like they met each other at the right time because he was able to carve out that figure, that loving, adoring partner who would sing the songs and show up in the promotional videos. I was also interested in her two children. So she's a son, Michael, a daughter, Elizabeth. Elizabeth seems to also be very frail. What was your sense in your research? The thing about this series, and I think that you see two sides to each person. It's hard to really walk away not feeling empathy for each character. And the Elizabeth is the one that really I'm troubled most by, and that I think that has been keeping me up mostly at night.
I feel exactly the same. I was shocked by how emotional I felt.
Yeah.
Even myself watching. I mean, I cried when I watched Michael's sequence for the first time, and I was like, I remember texting Marina and being like, I'm shocked that I feel this way,
yeah.
You know, knowing that he's also done terrible things. You know, part of what originally drew me to this story is this idea that I play with a lot in my work of, you know, we are raised in our parents' shadow.
Mm-hmm.
What that looks like when you are, you know, you're raised in an environment. I've written about like homeschool communities and what that looks like when you take a child out of, you know, the bubble becomes smaller and smaller. And so in this case, you have to understand that this is their entire life,
yeah,
you
sure.
know? And I think that that is really hard because Michael clearly struggles with being, as they would say, in the message. He struggles with his weight. He struggles with alcohol. He's had, you know, struggled with infidelity. And everyone knows that. It's very well known in the church. He will disappear for months at a time. But what does he do? You know, what do you do in that situation? You leave your entire right. family, all of your friends, the person who owns your house, the person who did your insurance, your dentist, your employer, your doctor, your children's doctors. You know, that element is so strong for any member of Remnant, any member of any group like this. That's the whole, you know, that's the whole issue I'm explaining, you know, what a cult is, which is obvious. But that element, when it's also your family, your entire family, your entire life, your entire career, you've never made money outside of your family. You have no relationships outside of that. It becomes just even harder. And I think that's, you know, it's hard because especially for Michael, I think, you know, would he be in Remnant
mm-hmm.
if he had not been born into it? I highly doubt it.
I agree.
Elizabeth is a little bit of a different case. And I worry a lot for Elizabeth because she does seem very frail and very ill. And, you know, thinking about what I was saying about a woman, you know, just thinking about as a woman, all the messages you get every day from,
yep.
you know, magazines and TV about your body and what you need to look like and how you need to please your husband and how you need to be submissive and be a good mom and a good wife and pretty and skinny.
Mm-hmm.
That coming from a religious leader. So someone saying not just you need to be skinny or else you're not going to be loved, but you're going to be, if you're not skinny, you're going to hell forever. Plus that being your mom
yeah.
and you being a young girl growing up in this, I mean, you know, born into this environment. And we have stories of kids, you know, not Elizabeth and Michael specifically, but it's common knowledge that they were on these programs as youth as well. But, you know, these are 9-year-olds being told to lose weight, you know, 9-year-olds being, you know, little kids. So to have that from pretty much day one just compounds the levels of control. And as much as, you know, I want to be like run for the hills and there's so much more to life out there for you guys. It's hard to imagine that you can undo the entire, it's every thread of their being. You know, it's not just pulling yeah. one thread, it's the entire fabric. And I don't, you know, it's hard to know how you could possibly unpack that for them.
And also to have horrible life experiences happen and not be able to seek therapy because it's you're told that you can just pray.
100%. The only people that they could go to was Gwen and the other leadership. Elizabeth's baby was alive. She had an infant that died. And you had a miscarriage. Like, you should be fine if she's fine.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So one of the cult interventionists in this series says the remnant culture is completely devoted to controlling the exposure to the external world, which is why they created a whole series of networks that include childcare and homeschooling initiatives as a way of keeping the children within the milieu of the group. And because of the culture, you can leave the children with other adults easily. So children can be watched over by anyone that's older. So the authority line doctrine empowers children to be as young as 9, disciplining other children as young as 5 without any input from parents. So you have 2 layers of here of authority. You have leaders of the church, all men, who are telling you how to raise your children. And then they're basically setting up a structure that older children can also tell your children how to behave. And they're all reliant on the same philosophy, which is complete obedience, to the point where they expected 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds to sit in a 3-hour church service. And then in some cases, spank them, hit them with glue sticks to keep them obedient. As mentioned, there is a case that's discussed in the series about a little boy. This must have been a really hard part of the filmmaking process for all of you.
Joseph Smith's case never really broke through. And it's a tragedy, a completely unavoidable tragedy. And the fact that more people don't know about it, and the fact that his parents are serving life sentences while running a ministry for the church at the prison, recruiting other people in prison to Remnant Fellowship, that Remnant has completely defended and protected these parents. To this day, they pray for the Smiths frequently. That was horrifying, but also extremely motivating because nobody is looking out for Joseph Smith, and no one is looking out for kids like him and Remnant. And that was really sad. And yeah, I mean, the authority line is, you know, there's a real openness in terms of anyone can really discipline your child. And I think that's the important thing, in the sense that it's not like I think in most churches, you're not having like your fellow congregant spank your child.
No.
If you found out that someone you knew from church had hit your child or disciplined them or yelled at them, most people would be upset. That is extremely common and completely approved by Remnant. If you are in leadership, you are top of the game. So it's, like you said, all the men and then usually their wives. They are the authority figures over everyone else. But then when it comes to ages, it is solely by age. So you can have a 14-year-old disciplining an 11-year-old. It is only age and nothing else. So you could have a 14-year-old who's not very well behaved, you know, disciplining a younger child who is. You have kids left with older kids. You have, you know, you don't really know. That's the thing we've heard from a lot of parents is there are times where you don't know where your kids are. You don't know whose house they're going to be at. You don't know who's taking care of them. You're told you guys go into the church, let the kids do this, or, you know, we're going to go into this event and let the kids go. And there's sort of, because it's that environment, it's this, you know, I think communes are probably a comparison where it's like, we are raising our kids together. It is not these individual families, it is one family raising the kids together. And that's sort of the mindset where it's like, well, yeah, you can be disciplined by anyone because we're all raising these kids, the remnant children. The children belong to the church. The children do not belong to their parents. And that is, I think, a very important, that is the way the church would like it to be. But the children are remnant children. They are not, you know, Elizabeth's children or Michael's children, they're remnant kids. And that is why there's such an emphasis on keeping the children within the fold. There is this, it offers them a guarantee because it ensures that the legacy in the church will continue. And that is their ultimate motive.
So as I was watching this series, now I watched this a little bit ahead of time. So I had the luxury of perusing social media to look at pictures. And I kept thinking, do some of these church elders know about this series?
At this point, I think most of the elders know. We started reaching out in January, sending them letters. You know, we have a very solid line of communication that we attempted. They have not engaged. But they have responded and we know that they've acknowledged, they did end up providing us a statement that we'll be including at the end of the series. So at least we know that the key people know. We don't know how many people know. We also know, you know, it would be very typical of Remnant for them to do everything they can to make sure that their people don't see this doc.
Which is par for the course.
Very par for the course. Yeah. So, you know, if I had to hypothesize, I would guess that some of these leaders know, not all of them, only the top ones. I would guess Elizabeth knows, Michael knows. We sent them letters, so they definitely know. The lawyers know, everyone like that. I don't think they're making announcements about it at church. I think that they're probably doing their best to minimize access during this time. So we will see. I mean, we definitely, you know, they know, they know that something's coming. I don't think that they know how long I've been working on this. I don't think that they know what we've collected. I would assume that they think that we're capitalizing on the deaths, which is, you know,
not true.
Not at all true. The date was, this was always the date for our premiere. We'd already been done, you know, a year of filming. You know, we were already very much all, nothing has really changed since then, except for our strategy a little bit. But this is certainly not something where, like, after they died, we, you know, rushed to put this together. This has already been happening. I know that they're going to probably, that's going to be their interpretation of it. And what they tell, I would assume, to everyone else is that we're just people trying to capitalize on the deaths. And, you know, it's unfortunate because that's definitely not what we're trying to do. But we came into this knowing that, you know, even if a few people from Remnant watch it and question, or a few family members of people who are in Remnant watch it in question, that's enough.
Some of the church elders would log into people's congregants' social media accounts. So there is a lot of control on their part of what the congregants see. So that's really fascinating. As mentioned, the couple, Gwen and Joe, died in a plane crash in May with two other couples and Gwen's son-in-law. You had already been working on this project for quite some time when this happened. This must have been shocking.
It was, I mean, there's really no words for how shocking it was. It was beyond my wildest, if you had asked me, you know, a few months before that happened, like what would be the craziest thing that could happen to your series at this point? Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know if I would have come up with that. It is the right turn, the curveball none of us could have ever imagined and certainly wouldn't have wished for. It's a tragedy objectively, absolutely. You know, and I think we've really, that's why we want, you know, we're not capitalizing on their deaths. So that's important for people to know, I think, but also, you know, it's still a story that needs to be told. And I think that we kind of went through that, you know, figuring out who was on the plane, making sure that there weren't any kids on the plane, because that was a big question at the beginning. And then, you know, having conversations among ourselves and also listening to our sources. You know, I think that for me is like the biggest thing in my work and the biggest thing in this project was like, I felt like I found these people who had just been screaming into the void about this and trying to get someone to listen to their stories. And so I just see myself as sort of this like middleman where I'm able to get these stories to all of the people who should hear their stories. But they are the ones who we keep coming back to, and they're the ones that we take our cues from. And I think I've been really lucky where Campfire and Marina and HBO Max, like we all are on that, have that same mentality. And so in those days, you know, there was so much uncertainty around it. But what we were hearing from all of our sources was like, I really hope that this doesn't change anything. And it doesn't mean that the doc isn't going to happen. Because for all these people to have given us interviews and opened up all of this, for them to think that that would have been for nothing, that would have been like, I wouldn't have been able to live with myself and letting them down in that way. And so everything I said is still true. And the church is still there and it's still going. And they're recruiting more people every day. So, you know, that left us with, I think, a real responsibility to go forth and tell these stories and bring it to the public in the way that we intended.
This is the docuseries to watch for the year, you guys. You will be obsessed. 3 parts, September 30th. This is outstanding. HBO Max, so well done. I'm waiting for the last 2 parts, which, of course, you are working on right now. Tell everybody where they can find you. Again, this is extraordinary. Great job.
Thank you so much, Kate. So you can find me at yesliketheriver.com or at yesliketheriver on Instagram or pretty much anywhere else, which is just like my fun name, a little nod to my name.
Can we just say also HBO Max, killing it.
They've also been the most incredible partners. I could not have wished for a better home for this. And I feel just so lucky to be putting it out on a platform that is making such incredible content and that people can rely on for doing the right stories in the right way. And that mm-hmm. is, I could not have asked for a better experience working with them. So I feel that way as a viewer, but also as a producer, like they are killing it on all ends. So
all ends. It's just really, this is so great. Thank you a million times. I'm so excited for everyone to see it. I'm dying to see what everybody else thinks. You've been sitting on this for 2 years. I've been sitting on it a couple of weeks. I'm bursting out of my skin. You must be too. So again, great job.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you and I'm excited for everyone to see it.
I want to thank my great guest, Niles, and remind you guys to click subscribe, leave a 5-star review. Check out my Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, to talk about this episode, also what you're listening to, what you're reading, and the shows that you're watching. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. Go over there and check out the videos that I've done with Jonathan Mark this week about the Gabby Petito case and other unsolved mysteries. You can, again, check that out at Kate Casey CA on Instagram. I'm on TikTok at It's Kate Casey. My list of what to watch comes out every Monday. You can go to katecasey.substack.com to sign up for that. You will get it in your email box every Monday. And I'm going to give you about 7 to 10 things that you can watch every week. And it's a great guide, especially as you go into the weekend. And then you can check out my Patreon for bonus episodes. And I've been doing a ton this week with Jonathan Mark on missing and unsolved cases. So check that out. I'm hoping that you have a great week. And my next guest will be Mia Thornton from The Real Housewives of Potomac.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.